This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, a chance to stare into the void and then beyond it, to the pulsing heart of a universe alive with possibility, or at least to a reality so absurd we can only choose to laugh together. That's right, I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, stand-up comedian and Midwest existentialist Brendan Lemon.
I don't want to be in a Black Mirror episode. I don't want somebody to download my intelligence in a computer for all eternity. Like, I think it's a lot better that we have a finite amount of time that we have to make the best of.
Brendan is going to walk us through the existential abyss, where we find out there's actually something funny about all this. It's time to intervene on behalf of humans and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human.
So do you ever notice you might have a conversation with some friends in which you express something about something that's going on in the world, let's say the Israel-Palestine conflict right now, and you say your opinion, you're like, oh my gosh, this is what I think about this, and then you start to disagree, or they disagree with you, and when you start talking to them about it, what becomes quickly apparent is that you actually can't agree on even a basic set of facts about what is even happening. And because of that basic set of facts is different, you start immediately having differences in the cause and effect of what happened and where things came from and why people made the decisions they were making in the first place. And as you talk with them, it seems strange. It's not just the case that you can't agree on a narrative of what happened, but it almost seems like some of the people in the conversation, including maybe you, are just reacting to whatever the last bit of information that came out actually was. You find yourself in a situation in which all of history, maybe all of narrative, both is and isn't true at the same time. That no matter what's happening, it seems to be happening in a kind of eternal present with no explanation, only reactions. And not only are there many different types of narratives that are available which could explain what we're observing in the moment, all of those seem equally plausible to one another. Well, in 2013, this phenomenon was described by Douglas Rushkoff in his book, Present Shock. In this book, Douglas Rushkoff outlines not just narrative collapse, but some other really strange-sounding phenomena like digiphrenia and fractal noia. Now, this concept of narrative collapse, I think, is extremely important to understand the world we're living in today. This idea of a post-narrative type of storytelling. Now, Rushkoff would say that in years past, human beings had to construct a narrative through their own senses and observations or in conversation with one another. That you would construct a narrative communally and people would basically understand what happened in the world and would be able to interpret it that way. But because we live in a time in which everything is now filtered through the internet, through all kinds of different ways, including deep fakes and edited or photoshopped things and AI creation, we no longer have the ability to really put a narrative together in the way that we used to. And now, all of these stories effectively exist post-narrative. And that world of increasing simulation is what Jean Baudrillard would call hyper-reality. That is, we're living in a type of reality divorced from our actual experience of it. Now, because of this phenomenon, Rushkoff notices that there are three basic things that are going on in media in a reaction to it. The first is that stories tend to not have consequences anymore. And in fact, he cites The Simpsons as a very good example of this. That is, nothing of consequence ever happens in the show. The family doesn't change. It's been almost 30 years. The family is exactly the same. The second is that the viewing experience itself becomes the kind of narrative. That is that you're not watching the Kardashians because it's interesting, you're watching it ironically. You're having fun watching it because you're like, look at these idiots, or whatever your reaction to it is. A lot of reality TV functions from this premise. And the third is that the viewing experience becomes less about consuming the story in order to discover the resolution of the plot, and more of a kind of experience of piecing together what's actually happening. And the specific example Rushkoff uses here is The Walking Dead, which is interesting because if you pick up that show at almost any point, you have to spend a bunch of time going, okay, wait, what's actually happening right now? Okay, so what, Brendan? People are consuming media differently. That's always happened. What does that matter? Great question. This becomes less theoretical and far more scary when you begin to apply this to real-world events such as the January 6th insurrection, wherein the people who engaged in it were surprised that there were somehow any actual consequences for their actions. Or people, Donald Trump amongst them, watch what happened with a kind of weird, cool, collected, reserved, oh, look at this craziness that's happening, as if it wasn't actually happening in the world. And finally, an insane, continuous conversation about what actually happened that day, as if for some reason we didn't have tons and tons of evidence of exactly what happened that day. And the consequences of this are extremely grave. We can see it right now. All of the media is continuously talking about January 6th as if it was just a blip in the reality TV show of America and not a dire, insane, crazy, ridiculous, absolutely upending activity in the history of this country. It is because of narrative collapse. That is what Douglas Rushkoff would say. It is because of this increasing hyper-reality that we're in a situation in which we cannot actually agree on any narrative that happened. That is what narrative collapse is, and that is an absolutely terrifying thing for us to all now live in.
That was comedian Brendan Lemon on TikTok, honoring and humbling me by bringing some of the ideas of my 2013 book, Present Shock, up into our current socio-political psycho landscape. We've been playing email tag for a decade or so, but when he explained and expanded on the idea of narrative collapse for his zillion TikTok followers, I felt not only heard, but actually relevant. There's nothing better than an inspiring comedian, particularly one who can inspire us to see past the existential horror of our fractured narrative to mutual recognition and common ground that we can discover by laughing at our absurdity together. So here's my conversation with my new friend, Brendan Lemon. So you live and operate at the intersection of existential philosophy and stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, if anything, is the difference between those two things?
You know, I don't, you know, that's such a good question because, I feel like I also am involved with the IAPH, the International Association for Philosophy of Humor. And it's funny because the way I got involved was that there's a great book by John Marmish, who's a nihilist philosopher. And he basically, his theory is that is humor as a answer to nihilism. And absurdism, as Camus sort of talked about it, is kind of comedy exists in order to bring meaning to the void. Like, yeah, it's meaningless. Meaning is what you create it. There is no inherent meaning in life. So why don't we tell a couple of dick jokes and have a nice time? Like, that kind of feels like a not bad way to approach the void. I mean, you got to do something with your time, right? So you're either screaming or laughing at the void, I feel like.
Which is, I guess that's a kind of comedy, you know? I mean, and it's interesting because you could be laughing at the void. I mean, I'm thinking about Jewish comedy now and Borscht Belt comedy, which is all kind of, well, post-pogrom and post-Holocaust, that they're not laughing into the void so much as laughing into, because they believe in God and stuff, a lot of them, but they're laughing into evil, the inexplicable evil of this world that,
you know. Well, the Coen brothers, I think, are a great example of what you're talking about, because One of my favorite Coen Brothers films is A Quiet Man, A Serious Man. Pardon me. And that movie is so good. Like, the Coen Brothers have such a bead on Jewish humor in a response to a kind of nihilistic center of life. Because the end of that film, if you watch that movie, it's probably my favorite Coen Brothers film. Mm. And it's amazing because I forced my family to sit down and watch it once. And it's like not a very good family movie.
Right.
Because it just ends with this like there's a storm coming and this guy gets news that this isn't giving anything away, I don't think, but it's like maybe something terrible is going to happen to the main character and you don't know. And then the film just ends. you have no resolution. There's no, and for me, there is a kind of sublime appreciation for how life actually is in that. And like, there's a whole bunch of absurd things that happen. Like, this guy's enemy dies in a random car accident in the movie. Like, mm-hmm. there's no resolution to so many stories in this film. And that feels so accurate to life. And there's a kind of humor that comes along with it. They're very good at like drawing out that specific kind of right. aesthetic
it's
that I think is reflective of real life.
And, you know, and it relates to your response to Present Shock, which is interesting because a lot of comedians and filmmakers responded to Present Shock over the years. I mean, Present Shock's the one that got, you know, Bo Burnham to start talking about me. You know, Present Shock's what got, Steve Soderbergh to start talking. It's like, I guess the underlying question then is, so we had narrative that helped us make sense of things. So I grew up, you know, when I was a baby, you know, you got John F. Kennedy, we're gonna go to the moon, you know, we're gonna stick a flag in there and we will have won. You know, we got Martin Luther King, you know, we're gonna go arm in arm down and I have a dream and we're gonna get to that dream. And we have these stories about who we were and how we came. We're an immigrant family and we worked hard to get you to school so you could be a doctor, right? Which I didn't, but you know, right. So you could be a what? But you know, I broke the narrative, right? But the stories gave us a sense of, we knew where we were in the arc. We used it to orient ourselves and have a sense. It felt less like existential despair when you have a story. So do you feel like which is real, I guess? So Present Shock and digital technology and the eternal now and all that stuff that you're talking about and that I talk about, it's like really disorienting and scary and we're kind of desperate. So we try to tie things together and do fractal noia, you know, create this kind of pointillist narratives. You know, people would rather believe that the World Bank and the Great Reset, that there's a coherent plan by an elite to eliminate 3/4 of the planet with a virus. They rather believe that than believe that nobody knows what the fuck is going on, that everybody is as clueless as Jimmy Carter in the third year of his presidency, right? And it's all just like, let's just wear sweaters and be nice to each other.
I love this so much.
Which is it? In other words, so is the narrative itself, the story, as I've believed, as Brecht believed, as I'm sure all those French guys that you've read believe, is the story a fake, almost palliative care for the existential despair and ultimate Becker death that we're all going to have? Or is the story kind of real? Narrativity and linearity is sort of real, and now we're in kind of a temporary inability to rely on it, to find it again.
Yeah, this is such a good question because first of all, I love your the fever pitch of your neuroticism around this is so perfectly like in tune with how I feel like we should be. I feel like somebody once told me when I got off stage that they were like, you know, it's weird because you come on stage and it's almost like the entire subtext of your stand-up comedy set is like, what the fuck? Like, it's And I'm like, yeah, dude, that's kind of how I feel like a lot of the time.
Right. We don't even have the space to get sort of George Carlin angry about it or Bill Maher cynical about it. We're steps before, just in the.
Yes. Yeah. What the? And because I think that, so it's, speaking of, we should talk about the George Carlin AI special later in this conversation. But it's interesting, Doug, because I feel like you touched on something with Present Shock that I feel like many creatives who have had our antennas up for a while could feel, but couldn't really describe, which was like there is a breakdown in the fundamental structure of our interpreted reality that made it intelligible that we now can no longer, I can't touch ground anywhere.
Right.
And so the thing that I think is so interesting that has happened really, I mean, certainly since you've written the book, but in the few years before the book came out, which I'm sure you were, you know, obviously very sensitive to, it was almost like we have a seventh sense. Jesus Christ, Brendan. We almost have a sixth sense. It's almost like we have our five senses and then we have this sixth sense, which is sort of an assembled narrative that we can put together. And the weird thing is almost as if a technology like glasses came into being, except in these glasses, everything was tinted by a corporate structure that attempted to want you to visualize the world in a very particular way, like rose colored or, you know, amber or whatever way they decided to manufacture these glasses. It's almost as if that has screwed up our ability to make a narrative that sticks and makes sense. And I think that inherent fracturing has caused all the symptoms that you've talked about. And it's really weird to try to exist in this type of reality because there hasn't been any narrative that does make sense. Because you're right, like there was a legacy programming that came around after sort of the Second World War that was, hey, you were a part of this country, your people came here, you know, who knows how, and now you're here, and if you work hard, you can succeed, and this is the way that we all believe, and everybody's always done this, and this is the way it's always going to be. And the weird thing about that program was that starting really in 1971, and then I would say throughout especially the Reagan era, that has been increasingly fractured through neoliberal policy after policy. And it's fascinating because it's not just true. You've done a very good job of outlining it, not just in Present Shock, which I think is a book that effectively outlines the symptoms as experienced, almost the phenomenology of the individual experiencing, living through Present Shock. But you've also done a very good job in your most recent book, that Survival of the Richest, which I just finished recently, that I feel like was almost an indictment of sort of the, it was almost like, okay, Present Shock is how we're experiencing it, but let me talk about the environment that we're now living in the world. It almost feels like that's a good description of this kind of fracturing and falling apart, an inability to assemble a narrative in the world. Because what it's done is it's created a space in which self-interested, very powerful, mostly corporate entities have been able to take advantage of the gaps in that space and what's opened up in that narrative.
And not only have they taken advantage of the gaps, but these dudes are also victims of Present Shock. They are the last chapter of that book, right?
Yes.
Which I called Apocalypto, which is that world-ending thing. So where does the billionaire go with Apocalypto? Survival of the Richest. You upload your brain, you build a bunker, you do a thing.
We're going to go to Mars. We're going to colonize Mars. The image of that you talk about where you're like, it's almost as if they're trying to drive the car faster than the exhaust fumes. I'm like, this is so, because I think that the situation that we live in is really pretty dire and it's pretty bad in a bunch of different ways. But the one of the worst ways is that I think a lot of the people who you are talking about in Survival of the Richest, a lot of the billionaires, people who are going to the World Economic Forum, it's a great, I spoke with Peter Goodman, the guy who wrote Davos Man.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very similar situation. These are people who truly believe that they have figured out. I mean, they're getting massive amounts of money. They've received massive amounts of wealth, tons of attention. Heretofore unheard of amounts of attention and wealth the likes of which no pharaoh in ancient Egypt had ever experienced. And they can't help but believe that they have the answers to all of these questions because everything around them is telling them that they do. And they really truly believe that the answers that they're going to give, which is like, hey, we're going to accelerate ourselves through this process. They're completely numb to the fact that there are massive amounts of externalization costs that they're producing all the time from the endeavors that they're undertaking. And they're completely oblivious to it. That's actually worse than if they were the heads of the conspiracies that people believe that they are. Like it's actually worse than if they were drinking adrenochrome. I wish that was actually the situation. That would be so much easier to remedy.
It's simple, exactly. I mean, I still feel bad for the shipping containers filled of, you know, underage girls from different countries. Yes. But at least we could find the shipping container, open it up, go, here's the girls, there's the guy, kill that dude, free these girls, yay. You know, again, victim, vanquished.
We
would
just have to go to the pizza place and open the basement.
Yeah. and do it and arrest Hillary once and for all. Exactly. But you know, and that harkens back though to my nostalgia for cause and effect reality, right? I mean, it's we lived in a world, you know, it's easier sometimes to talk to business people about it because I'll talk to them, I'll say, okay, so you used to make a product, you'd put it on the shelves, and at the end of the quarter, you'd find out how it sold, and then you could change the product or not. Now it's like, everything's happening in real time. Cause and effect has turned into a feedback loop where you can no longer distinguish between the cause and the effect. I did that first. Yeah. It was in, I did this 1999 documentary called Merchants of Cool, which was about the people.
The I remember.
Anthropologist marketing from MTV. And I was like, okay, so you're putting a camera in the closet of the kid to see what clothes he's buying so that you could know what ads to put and what to dress people on the show so that kids will imitate it. So who's watching who?
I remember. So I remember that documentary because we watched that. I was in 10th grade and we watched that documentary. But I remember the moment because you were like, oh, I finally got it.
Yeah.
They take an image of these kids and they feed it back to themselves. And so because there's a weird kind of divorce, this is exactly Baudrillard's like concept, I think, of hyper reality in the sense that this is a simulacra. Like we are looking at an object without a referent. We're looking at MTV is telling you this is cool because it's showing you images of yourself, but you're not actually authentically the object any longer. You're imitating the imitation that you were doing to originally begin with.
But then we do that. I mean, I wrote in the 90s, I wrote about really early the O.J. Simpson moment. That was such a weird television moment because in L.A., people watched the white Bronco in this slow police chase. There was this white Bronco escaping from police and they would see, oh my gosh, it's coming down near where I live. They would walk out of their house and onto their own TV screen. They kind of had time to do that and come back and then look at a video of themselves on the overpass where the thing is going by. And then I thought of that, you know, when you talked about the January 6th.
I almost wish that Jean Baudrillard wrote an essay called the Denver Bronco, the Bronco Chase did not exist. Like, I feel like there's something about it that feels extra, like, I don't know, and similar to the Gulf War.
Rather him do it than Zizek, though, who would go, it doesn't exist and you should all die or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't, the thing about the Bronco Chase was that it doesn't exist.
Like, I love that guy so much.
I know, but you know, he's as accelerationist as anybody when it kind of comes down
to it.
He gets a little scary. But it reminds me though that Bronco moment of going onto the camera and then being on the TV but not knowing what you are anymore is the sort of the moment. And I understand what the Republicans are saying when they look at the videotape of the people after they.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Break into the Capitol. They're like, yeah. What happened? What are we doing now? I mean, some of them were, you know, bad guys or whatever, but most of them are just like, what?
they were like unprepared for the reality of their own creation.
Right.
Like because you identify it. You do a pretty good job of identifying it in Survival of the Richest, where you talk about like I'm a huge nerd. Like, I grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons and live action role playing. I remember dressing up like it was the Middle Ages and running into the woods with like fake weapons and like hitting each other. So I watch it and I'm like, oh, I know what this is. This is live action role playing. These guys are cosplaying.
They're LARPing. So, I look on the college campuses now and it looks like that to me. These kids, I mean, God bless them. I understand. And yes, stop the bombing. Stop the bombing. Yes. But there's a cosplaying attitude or approach to it. It's like, we've seen this on Twitter. Now we're going to go into the quad on our $90,000 a year school and, you know, and argue for something. And it's just like, there's a role playing quality to it, but for everybody now.
Yes. And what an exciting narrative to get caught up in, man. What a cool identity to give yourself. Like, and the thing that I think is weird is having this conversation is like slightly dangerous, because I just want to be clear about this, because what I'm not saying is that every person who's like, hey, we need to, you know, the Palestinians need a place to be safe and shouldn't be bombed innocent people, or that like whatever that happens to be. I'm not saying that those things don't have merit, or that people who are protesting for a fair shake for what's happening in the Middle East are wrong. That's not what I'm saying.
Or even that everybody who's marching on the Capitol who feels disenfranchised from the political process is wrong either.
Yes. So that's what's so challenging about the media and cultural environment in which a conversation about either of those two topics has to happen is fraught with so much misunderstanding and zero space for nuance. Because I got in a lot of trouble because, like, look, I got a lot of family members who voted Trump, were pro Trump. I got a few family members who are QAnon supporters, right?
And how do you support QAnon? I mean, I know, but I guess full-fledged, innocent.
They're emotionally supporting.
Right.
They're karmically supporting
to QAnon Central. Okay.
No, I don't. I hope Ron White has gotten zero of their dollars. anyway, what I'm saying is that they end up the conversation that I wanted to have was impossible, because when you say, hey, some of the people who march on the Capitol have legitimate grievances, it's almost like what people hear when you say that is like, that was totally correct for them to do
that. There's good people on both sides. Right. But but on a certain level, I understand what
Ron Watkins, pardon me, not Ron White, Ron Watkins.
Right, Ron Watkins. But I understand what Trump means when he says there's good people on both sides. You know, there's good people on every side.
Yeah, that's not the
fucking
point.
It doesn't mean guys with torches are good people, right?
No one is having a conversation. Like, right. There is a, in order to, by focusing on the act, I'm a man with no country, because on one hand, I will have conversations, so I make that TikTok,
you're a cis
right?
man with no country.
I'm a cis straight white man with no country.
Right. And the mustache just exacerbates all of those things.
This is for self-defense. Yeah.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
So
you wouldn't get attacked if you didn't have it, though. So you wouldn't need it.
Watch out.
It's a self-referential thing.
It's a cybernetic feedback loop.
Thank you.
So. Just like in the TikTok, at the end of the TikTok, I talk about like, hey, you know, this is January 6th is like a great example of all of these things, and here's how it plays out. I have all of these people who are messaging me being like, this is so dumb, I can't believe you'd think this. And they start equating, like, you wouldn't say this about BLM protests, what about that? We're like, dude, you're missing the point. Like, whether or not, like, look, you can indict the actions of people who are protesting something. But the problem is, if you remove from the conversation the principles that are at stake or the things that they're talking about, you actually don't have to engage with any real concepts.
Right.
You can only just talk about whether or not the people who did things are right or wrong. Like whether or not racial justice is even something that exists or needs to be pursued in the United States falls out of the conversation completely. And the same thing is true, I think, with this January 6th thing, which is that there are the legitimate grievances that these people have. I think they accurately are aware that, like, a lot of them, if you look at their occupations, are all petit bourgeoisie people who are effectively like realtors and like insurance people, small business people. And like, they're accurately aware that their lifestyle is about to go away because it's getting hit with a tidal wave of corporate like takeover for everything that they're doing. And they really do see Donald Trump and QAnon and this conspiracy as a way that explains why their lifestyle is disappearing and the worlds they're living in are changing. Now, they're wrong, I think. They're super wrong.
Right.
But their grievances are real, right, based on real things.
Right. But it doesn't change the fact that there has been a pseudo event constructed in the name of real grievances. And people are stepping into that pseudo event, right? Into that non-real thing. And then the pseudo event ends up having violence. The people die in the pseudo event. This is not
real violence.
Abby Hoffman holding hands around the Pentagon, you know, trying to levitate the thing. There ends up being real.
No, and you're exactly right. Like this was a pseudo events that had real outcomes. Now, I think it was Mark Fisher was talking about this in a capitalist realism, where he was saying that it's very bizarre because in a weird flipping of what we understand from mid 20th century, we meaning the West, capitalist democratic powers, saw communism as creating a false reality in which people who could, you know, basically conspired in pseudo events that had real outcomes. That I think the exact example that Fisher uses is the canal that I think Stalin had dug across like whatever part of Russia that had so many people die digging of it. And it was never useful. It was done specifically only just to impress Western democratic powers. It never had any actual use value. The thing that's very bizarre is
nowhere.
Road to nowhere. Real people died in order to produce these pseudo events. But the opposite is now happening in the West, where pseudo events are actually killing real people, which is completely bizarre. And I have some sympathy for this because like I have members of my family who will have full throated endorsements of like, you have to understand like, you know, these Democrats are stealing children and they are drinking the blood of children. And it's bizarre because you can show them, I can give them a copy of Douglas Hofstadter's Paranoid Style in American Politics and be like, please read this because you are echoing sentiments of 17th and 18th century Americans when they talk about Catholics. Like, but you're doing it now, except with Democrats.
Right.
Zero self-reference.
I know. I get no traction with that either. Like, so that doesn't mean it's not true this time. Or I'll show them Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And they go, maybe they were onto something. You know, it's like, so, you know, where do you even go, you know, with that?
Well, I don't know. And that's what's so terrifying is I think that there's a kind of absurdism that here's the weird thing about doing comedy in this environment, which is that if these things weren't so serious, they would be hilarious. Like Armando Iannucci in The Death of Stalin does a very good job of drawing out the humor in real, deadly, serious situations. And it's exactly the same thing that if I made a reality TV show, Or even a not a reality TV show. I mean, there's already a reality TV show. Like there are so many comedians who on TikTok and on Instagram who go to Trump rallies and just interview people. I mean, Jordan Klepper is a great example from The Daily Show. We'll interview people there and ask them basic questions that they will get completely wrong about like things that we understand. And I'm not talking about crazy, like, is the world flat or something like this, but just like really basic questions about like, well, do you guys understand how the Electoral College works or something like this? And like completely misunderstanding. But like there, if I wrote a satire of this situation, it would be hilarious. But living in this reality is terrifying. And I feel like there's a weird distancing. And I think that this has to do with things. I think that this is an example of the things you wrote about in Present Shock, because the the distance, the removal that people have from their own lived experience is also very bizarre. Like the surprise, and I talk about this in the TikTok, the surprise that people have to being like, wait, I'm getting arrested? Like, hold on, what? Like, I went, dude, you broke into the fucking Capitol building. Like, I went to the rally to restore sanity back in like 2000, and I think it was like 2011 or something like that. This was a giant thing that Jon Stewart had put on in the Capitol Mall, and thousands of people were there. It was crazy. I climbed a tree to get a better view of the stage.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you know anything about Capitol Police, but they do not put up with that stuff.
No, I know, like, they don't like that. Did they arrest
you?
So
I'm in. They almost arrested me. So I'm up in the tree, and the next thing I hear is, "Get out of the tree! Get out of the tree!" And they're running up. There's eight of them, and they have M16s, and they're all pointed at me. And I'm like, "What the?" And I it's me and my buddy, and we jump out of the tree, and this guy shoves me up against the tree. And he's like, I go to put my hands in my pockets as I'm waiting there. He points the gun at me. He's like, get your hands out of your pockets. I mean, the point I'm making is that these guys put up with nothing. They do not put up with anything.
Right.
And so, like, the fact that you're getting arrested because you broke into the Capitol building. Like,
right.
How do you not understand this?
And that's why I understand when you know, whatever, Republican senators or Trump, not that they're calling them hostages and all, but when they're saying, this wasn't what you think it was. In some version of at least those people's reality, it wasn't. It was like they were going on Jerry Springer, and then Jerry Springer says, "Okay, we want you to kind of fight here and then do that." They were cosplaying something to a large extent. The guy had friggin' horns. You know, he had horns. That's not the way you seriously.
Yeah. Jason
overtake.
Chansley, poor the QAnon thing. Shaman.
But everything, this is my feeling lately, and it's partly because I've been getting a little bit more organic in my sensibilities. Maybe it's as I get closer to death and the worms are starting to circle or whatever it is. You know, I'm older now. But I was thinking that our whole civilization, right, office work and buildings, the whole jobs, all the jobs that people go to, are kind of bullshit jobs, right? They really kind of are. The farming is real, right? Farming is real. And not the way we do it. Now we just, you know, kill the topsoil, turn the stuff over. We got like 12 harvests left and it's the end of the planet, right? So, but doing real farming, some permaculture organic way, and you just stick the seeds in there rather than mash the whole thing up and all that.
Yep.
That is what we've spent like 1,000 years trying to get away from. It's like, that's dirty work. That's the bad work. That's what the slaves do. And it's like, you get away from it until maybe you get rich and retire. And then you get an organic garden, right? Which is the fun thing. But it's like, isn't every job a whole thing? This whole thing is a pseudo event. Is fake, is simulacra.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I really think so. There was I really agree with Mark Fisher in Capitalist Realism. I'm not sure if you've read this book, but I really agree with Mark Fisher. And I mean, look, this is a guy who is. I mean, I almost reluctantly say you shouldn't believe everything he says, because like he is serious. And if you read the book, you'll understand what I mean. But I really believe what he says, where it's like this whole thing is just a kind of weird kabuki theater that we're all sort of singing and dancing in. And David Graeber's correct, where he says like the secret of the world is that we make it and we can just as easily make it differently.
Right, which is what I would – that's positive. That's so optimistic for a guy who's unfortunately dead now over
– Unfortunately, I would argue, rest in peace, Dave.
Stress. Yeah. You know, he was – he's almost really a victim of stress. Like, emailed with him a few times and I was just like, oh man, this guy's, he's worse than me in terms of being overwhelmed and doing too much.
Tightly
and,
wound.
Yeah. Tightly wound.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's challenging because like, you know, you, the kind of work that you do, the kind of work that David did, the kind of work that Mark Fisher did. I mean, like you're staring into the void. You really are. You're going, you're looking at there's a lot of bullshit, I think. And I think that there's a lot of bullshit, and there's a lot of people who get rewarded by believing and talking and
mimicking
bullshit.
You make a lot
mimicking
more money
bullshit.
Supporting wealthy people's bullshit than you do pulling back the curtain and exposing it as either evil or entirely unnecessary.
And I think that there's a heaviness. There's a spiritual toll that I think comes from not only recognizing the monster that you're dealing with, or the void, whatever you want to call it, but then doing battle with it. And then trying to be like, I'm serious. Like, I'm trying. David Graeber, when you read David Graeber's work, and when you read Mark Fisher's work, especially David Graeber's, I am trying to save the human race from itself, is almost what comes across. And Mark Fisher's.
Yeah, but they do it in that kind of, this is the only way I can say, kind of Verso Books way. They do it in a kind of, you know, and God bless them all, but that kind of take no prisoners, I am serious, I am a fucking abolitionist about this stuff way.
Yeah, there's very little joy. Right. There's not a lot of joy.
But the alternative, and that's why I love what you're doing, the alternative, and I don't know if we're just fooling ourselves here, but the alternative is theater and comedy, right?
Yes.
So when I would do my regular Present Shock Talk, it kind of wouldn't work except on really kind of smart audiences who were already kind of Marxist or something. But when I would do it in a stand-up way, I mean, I used to do this thing, I don't think it's even in the book, maybe it is, where I talked about the Real Housewives of Orange County. And I use this as, and I said, you know, I figured out everything I need to know about media and society watching The Real Housewives. You know, I'm a media theorist. I always look at communication. And I went, why is communication breaking down between these women? They're same socioeconomic background, the same language, the same culture. And I realized what it is they have so much Botox in their faces that they can't make facial expressions that are consonant with the language coming out of their mouths. So
I love it.
It creates a kind of cognitive dissonance and distrust. You know, and I'll do that imitation of that. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear your daughter has cancer. You know, with their face trapped in a smile. And the other one thinks she's happy that my kid, I don't believe her. And that, and the audience, half of them have Botox, you know, the older women, but they still, they get it. It makes it makes it somehow easier, you know, a spoonful of sugar really helps the medicine go down.
But I think it's not just that. It's not just humor, which is true. But the thing that I love about comedy and humor is that there's a real kernel of truth in what you're talking about. And there's something that actually humanizes and gets people to realize that they're like, oh shit. Like the people who are controlling the entire world, they're human. And if they have Botox and have a negotiation with the leader of another country, the other leader could misunderstand their facial expressions.
Right.
Like that could actually happen.
Right.
Like it's a real outcome. And like the thing that's terrifying that people should realize. And this is what like sometimes when I argue with people in my family who are Trump supporters, they assign to this guy, not only do they assign to him qualities that he doesn't have vis-a-vis normal people, they assign him qualities that he doesn't have, like almost like he's a Greek hero or something. Like they're like, he's going to clean it up. He's going to go do all this. Dude, he can't even, bro, look at his family. Melania won't even let him in the car after her mother's, you know, passing. Like, believe me, dude, he can't even negotiate his way in his own family. Like, this is not the hero you think he is. But the thing that they assign to these people are characteristics that they super don't have. And it's like, it's almost like like tropes due to distance. We can project all of these things on all our hopes and wishes onto these people because we don't realize how flawed of human beings they really are.
And that was, I remember Obama at one point where he was saying, you know, these people are, you know, acting like I'm Che Guevara or something, and they don't realize my policies are actually closer to Reagan.
Yeah.
He had said it out loud. And it was like, dude, I remember it was like, this guy's great at branding. He's great at branding. Yeah. And yes, he was, you know, sophisticated and smarter than us and all that. No, but he was not what people projected onto him.
Yeah, and not just from the left, but from the right. Like all these people are like, Obama's going to take your guns, and you're like, bro, so many guns got per. He didn't do anything, and so it's weird because you can reflect this back to people. Like I remember I had an uncle who was like, man, Joe Biden is just going to let these cities. He's just going to let these people get crime ridden. I'm like, you're talking about 1990s tough on crime, Joe Biden. Like this is the guy you think is going to let all these? Like what are you talking? Like he has no precedent for this. Like, believe me, nobody hates Joe Biden more than Democrats, dude. Like, nobody likes this guy, okay? Like, believe me. Like, I get, if there's anything that you want to accuse him of, I might agree with you, but he's not the guy you think. You're accusing him of things that are totally unrealistic.
The Biden crime family.
Dude, I know, right? Like, like, Hunter Biden's got to, come on, dude. Like, what? And then the other thing is, not to keep us in this, like, in the mud here, but, like, if people always end up saying to me, like, well, what about Hunter Biden? And I'm like, dude, he should go to jail if he did anything illegal. Like, I don't understand why this is a, like, there is a weird, all of the, you mentioned this in the book, basically, which is like a lot of our human, there is so much technology that has been bent on trying to get our behavioral, through behavioral economics, to get our normal human switches, whatever you want to call them, to be used to fight each other and focus on a bunch of low-level BS. And like, and I don't know, the real question is, I don't know how we get our way out of it, how we solve this problem, because I think that the people who are convinced, like plunging headlong and trying to assign to conspiracy what I think is actually just incompetence. Like, I really think that the problem is worse than we think it is, because it isn't. I'm really fond of whoever the quote is from. Do not assign a conspiracy what can be explained by incompetence. Because I think, like, the problem is, like, we're just not that fucking smart. Right. And a lot of the things that we've put together are causing people to fight each other and focus on the wrong answers. And then we project answers that we wish did exist because they would be easier to solve and are easier to understand than the real actual complicated fact that the world is chaos and it's really complicated and we don't have that much control over it. And the things that we do control, we better focus on, but we're not focused on those. We're focused on the wrong problems and letting the wrong people control the things we can. That's my thinking.
Well, and it's also this, and I get it, you know, people like Elon Musk and all talk about direct democracy and everyone can vote on everything and all that. But it's like, I kind of want less authority over things rather than more. You know, here's, let's just take, how about just 1 million people around the world and make them in charge of like the pot. Is 1 million enough? And then the other 99.99% of us can just like take care of each other.
Yeah, and, we'll just
and
chill.
Chill. We'll be as just cooperative and nice to each other as
possible. You're arguing for Brave New World, basically. You're arguing for world controllers.
Well, not
in Brave New World.
But experts or people, a million of them though. I'm not talking, it's a million of them. And it's not a fun job. I promise you, it's not a fun, or we rotate, do random voting. You know, you're in charge today. Oh no, no. You're so sorry. But it's like the fact that we are supposed to have opinions on everything. So if you want to have, like, I got to have an opinion on the Afghanistan withdrawal policy. I got to have an, I got to do Houthis. I don't know enough about Yemen, right? So Yemen was,
I know that they own they own all the cannabis stores in New York, the Yemenis.
Well, maybe, but I mean, so I understand I'm supposed to know about, you know, the tens of thousands of people that are being killed in Gaza. I got that. But what about the hundreds of thousands of people? And this is whataboutism. What about the hundreds of thousands of people that were killed just next door by American missiles in Yemen? I don't understand that. I don't understand the Houthis. I don't understand all the players. I don't really understand the Sunnis either. Who's exactly? And then I don't understand, if I did, what is the actionable result of that other than voting
and
for either Trump or Biden, right?
Yeah, and why would that, and how does that affect your life? Like, I understand.
It affects their lives. I mean,
it affects their lives for sure.
And money is going to kill children in other places. I don't like that.
I can appreciate that. Like, I think that if you're someone who's conscientiously concerned with the well-being of others, I think it behooves you to want to go to your elected representatives and go, hey, I want you to go to whatever you go to in Congress and sincerely be like, let's not hurt people let's just not hurt them. Like, that makes sense. You want to go out to a protest? I guess that's okay. The thing that I think is a little odd, and I mean, I've talked about this before, is that there are homeless people in your own community.
Right.
Like, there are people outside right now who you do have the power to help. And you're not helping those people. You're actually just concerned with people who are completely, you don't know them, you'll never know them,
exactly.
They'll never know you.
And like, if you were helping those people, it would take some of the stress off these giant top-down architectures that are so brittle as to need war in other places. In other words, if you're helping your neighbor, we need less oil. If you're helping your neighbor, we need less political control over people in faraway places. There's less, you know, total angst.
I would say also, and you would have a real community, which is what the problem that a lot of the virtualization and parasocial relationships that we're creating are insinuating themselves into. A real community is the opposite of that. It's just, the United States, through an accident of, not an accident, but through a series of choices in history, has gotten to a place where most people don't live in places in which they can have an organic community. And as a result, these corporate powers have been able to insinuate themselves into our lives. I think the thing that is strange to me is just the feeling that, like, you just like, I know I reference Baudrillard a lot, but it's really amazing how much he saw coming. That, like, even from Simulacra and Simulation, The Transparency of Evil, The Gulf War Did Not Happen, like Paradox, all these other books that he wrote, the you know, The System of Objects, like all this stuff was really prescient in a way that I think is explains a lot of the world right now. That what you witness when you see people who are protesting, I think, Israel, Palestine, or, you know, I would go so far as to say probably even a lot of the Yemenis, although maybe I'm going to get some backlash from making this comment. I really think that a lot of that is a simulation of outrage or a simulation of protest, where it's like you could actually go help people in your real community, but instead you'd rather simulate being somebody who does care, and then you don't actually have to do anything.
Well, there's multiple things going on. On the one hand, there's terrific social justice, you know, aggravated social justice pleas and trying to move a government. On the other, there's a personal need to feel connected to something real. And the killing of babies is as real. It's real.
Yeah.
You know, there's with everybody in America, all of us white little puffy people, we've got no sense of indigeneity anymore.
White little puffy.
You know what I mean? We don't have indigeneity. So we kind of, our intersectionalism and our identity politics substitutes for that lack of a sense of indigeneity, of realness, right?
Yes.
If everything is fake, at least find where in the exact spectrum. I identify with you. I can wear your flag, your color, your thing. I could be an ally and not get yelled at now. But the strange thing is this, that so I think, like you, I am in a quest to return to the real and to help bring people back to the real. You know, I feel a little mosaic at that point. You know, I don't want to bring people to Canaan, the next promised land. I want to bring people to the desert, right?
Yeah.
Where we actually are. Here we are. You know, just be real. But when and many people want the real, but most of us who are striving for the real are striving for to get back. I feel like the GPS when it says return to the route, to get back in the story. They want to get back in the story that we understood, the cause and effect story, where I could do this thing and get to that thing and that. And I have a feeling the real, not just because of the internet, but the real may ultimately be storyless as well. You know, there is no, it's like story. If you want to have sex with a story, oh, you're going to get that woman, you're going to have sex and you're going to come, right?
Yeah.
You want to have sex for real? It's this tantric in between. I don't know who I am. I don't know who you are. Everything's melting. That's not,
I'm
confusing.
It's confusing and chaotic, and you have to be present for it, and it could hurt you, and things could go wrong. I think that there's a real desire. No, I'm serious. Like, I think there's a real desire. Well, Gen Z constantly talks about authenticity, right?
Right.
And like, I've had a lot of people have reacted to my content by saying, like, I feel like I'm walking down the street having a real conversation with you. Like, that's why this work. And I think it's true. I think that there's, because my brain is doing this all the time. Like, I'm not faking anything that I'm putting on, and I have no goal except to share. I'm trying to work these thoughts out myself. And I think that a lot of people watching are, I think your writing smacks of this exact kind of authenticity, which is like, oh, Doug, if Doug was alone in a room, he would be he would be thinking about this.
I'm thinking
this stuff
out loud, but then, you know, but hopefully refining, you know, refining the ideas for publication.
But the thing is, in order to exist in that space, you have to be willing to be vulnerable in a way that our world punishes, to be honest. Yeah. Like, I think that people would... Brené Brown had a quote, who's someone I never quote, but Brené Brown, she did this study of vulnerability, right? And in the first time that she did this study, she did it with women. And the idea was that, like, you feel more connected with your life when you end up becoming a more vulnerable person. And somebody told her, listen, you need to do this study with men. She didn't do it with men when she first started. When she started to do it with men, she realized very quickly that men are not vulnerable because they get punished really quickly if they end up becoming vulnerable. And I exactly. think that any man listening to this probably understands it. So, like, the thing that I think is kind of amazing, and just to get back to this, like, the point of me saying this is, like, Gen Z is obsessed with authenticity. That authenticity and vulnerability, the ability to live in a moment without being sucked into a narrative that you're playing yourself into in your head, is really challenging and difficult because there are bad things that can happen because of it. And I think not only that, but if you listen to the existentialists, meaning is what you create, right? There is no point to life. There is nothing that you do. You have to decide what it is. And I feel like there are so many available narratives that'll give you an identity, tell you who you are, all these kinds of things. I don't know if it's possible, but I think the hard work is really trying to figure out, apart from all of that, who am I? What do I like to do? What is my life about? What do I care about? What are the decisions I'm going to make, and am I going to assign meaning to them? That's hard work, actually, that you have to wake up and do every day. And I think that human beings have evolved to have stories that tell us these things so we don't have to do that hard work. And now, in right. a world in which a lot of those, like Lyotard says, meta narratives have all been destroyed, and there's a almost Hegelian other side to everything that we see now, like the internet is a context destroying machine, anything that you feel like you're going to take and feel like you're able to grab in order to feel good about yourself can be taken from you so quickly, with the exception of the fact that they're like, if there are children dying, I'm on the right side of that. Like, that's the one thing. And even if there aren't children dying, you're going to project that there are children right. dying to justify the narrative that you've bought into. That's what I think actually that existentialism is a way through this, but I think it's difficult. And I don't think that there's been a book or a direction written that is an easy answer to any of this. That's what I think. And I think nobody's going to do the work anyway.
You know, but Jesus kind of did it. Buddha kind of did it. You know, if you get stuck in the existential despair and all that, what can you do? Have compassion for others. Everybody's in pain. Try to help them metabolize it through by just being there as an open
but
nervous
Doug,
system.
How do
for
I become
them?
Rich and famous by doing that?
Ah, yeah, right, exactly. That's always the conversation I end up in with the rich people. It's like, okay, how do I do that and make $1 billion?
Yeah,
right?
I don't understand. How can I have, you know, six houses across different continents in a private jet when I'm doing those things?
You can't.
Yeah. Too bad.
You really
Sorry.
you can't not only can you not, but I would argue if you were actually doing that, you would not want those things.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that you probably would not want those things. Which means I'm not an enlightened person because I want 500,000 followers in a private jet so I can go out to sold out comedy shows around the United States.
You don't want a private jet. You really wouldn't want to do it that way. You would rather, wouldn't you rather them organize those shows around the United States so you can travel 20 miles in a car and do the next show and 20 miles so you're not getting jet lagged, so you're not doing
that's
that?
That's probably true. Actually, that's probably true. What I would prefer is to get a tour bus and then it would be fun to hang out
Electric.
With all my buddies. Yeah, it would be
solar-powered tour bus.
I think you just came up with my next. This is my tour, dude.
Right.
It's going to be
the Brent, bed and a pool table or whatever it is that you Midwesterners like.
Solar tour. Bowling alley. That's what Midwesterners like.
Could you imagine a bus with a bowling alley? That'd be great. That's even better than George Clinton's bus. Yeah.
Dude. Yeah. I want to ask you, just out of curiosity, have you spent much time in the Midwest?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot, you know, Cleveland, that counts as the Midwest, does it? Or is not
Cleveland's
quite?
Definitely the Midwest, man. Cleveland's the Midwest. Yeah. As much as my Michigander butt hates Ohio, I have to admit they are in the Midwest.
Cleveland, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, some Chicago. Just, more cities, though, than...
Yeah, not to derail or turn down this conversation, but I think it's rather interesting because I think the Midwest is actually there's a really good book called Midwest Futures by John Crispin, and he does a very good job of talking about how the Midwest was effectively a corporatized territory from the beginning almost. And it's very interesting
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating because I think that a lot of the my TikTok handle is at Brendan Freaking Lemon, but yeah. my name on it is Midwest Existentialism, and the big reason is because I think that have you heard of Midwest emo, the style of music? There's an existential nihilism that runs through the Midwest that is almost, I think, unique in the United States. I think that all people in small towns deal with a different type of existentialism, being sort of colonized by larger corporate forces that are impersonal, different, indifferent, all this stuff. But the Midwest feels almost uniquely this way in many ways. And I feel like you almost have to grapple with a lot of very heavy ideas because you sort of don't have another option. it's either watch Netflix and go to the local fast food place every day, or like, I've got to get out of here and read something that provokes something. And I feel like the it's interesting to me because I would wonder the reason I've asked if you've been to the Midwest is just simply because I feel like there are so many people who could benefit from, I think, a lot of what you're talking about.
I will tell you, I had the opposite experience of the Midwest whenever I went to the Midwest. The opposite experience of what I expected. I think of it as I'm on one of the coasts. I even was aware of this as a kid, living in Queens. I'm on the coasts with the corporations and all that stuff, right? But my experience on the coast of supposedly corporate reality was I knew our deli man. I knew our kosher butcher. I knew the shoemaker. I knew all the things. I go to the Midwest and it's like Waffle House.
Oh, yeah.
Cracker Barrel.
Cracker Barrel, buddy.
And it was – but – it was more corporatized. It was more franchised. Yes. It was more that.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, they're living in a more corporatized America in the middle, where we think of it as, oh, everybody's like, making, I don't know, corn or something. But
there's so much less sense of community. It's almost, I've written about this a lot, but it's more like functions almost like a colonized region in a strange way. Like, it's almost like it was colonized by the coasts, and it still functions as a kind of like Ireland in 1910 or something like that.
Right.
Like, and they look back. Obviously, without the troubles.
Right. And they look back to the era when it was the coal mining family colonizing them and forcing them to go into caves and whatever and get black lung better than being colonized by some, Chinese and New York place to make solar panels in a factory. So they're looking back, but it's not original. It's not, and I guess there were, that's the main thing I want to do with my retirement savings. And I've got this guy, he won't let me do it. He's like, oh, you can't do that.
Is this guy your financial advisor? Is that the guy?
Yeah, the financial advisor guy.
I'm just
runs,
making
like,
sure
know,
that it's not just
a dude
some
on
guy.
The street. Like TIAA CREF, where professors, we put our money in these things and they want you to put it into things. Even if you call it the environmental fund, it's the S&P fund with like three bad companies removed. It's not. They're like, oh, but you're in the social justice fund. I'm like, this is not social justice. This is still, this is like those same things. It's Microsoft and Apple and Amazon and every company I critique. But there's like farmland something. So you can basically, invest in, it's a system where you invest in small family farms at a very low interest rate so they can get, and he's like, well, you can't do that. I'm like, I think I can. But there are still family farms, a few. There's still a movement to, if we could promote small family ownership of land where they want to actually preserve the topsoil rather than, suck it dry and depend on Monsanto for a new drug, to grow crap on crap. It can be done. So there was and still is a Midwest that's not Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, and you should really check out John Crispin's book, Midwest Futures, because he does talk about kind of some of this concept. I think it's strange because you really identify it. You do a very good job. Your latest book, the Survival of the Richest, I think does a very good job of drawing a lot of different sources of information, resources, I would say, together in a rather elegant way to describe, I think, the sort of the situation we find ourselves in. Because I think that one of the things I did want to talk to you about before we run out of time is it is interesting because you identified it not just in Apocalypto, but then in the final chapter of Present Shock, but also you talk about it a little bit in the new book, which is that there is an almost millenarian
the world.
Desire for to bring about the eschaton, as you were talking about, to bring about. There is a religious, for like almost righteousness to the destruction of something that people who are proponents of, specifically, I would say, January 6th, that the people who have been arguing with in the comments so much, want to bring about. And I think that they're not wrong in this weird way that, like, there does need to be a kind of ending of whatever it is the tech class of billionaires operates under the delusion of, this nonstop growth that can just continue going. There has to be an end to that kind of thinking in order for us to go to the next thing. But I don't know, like, you're very critical of accelerationism. I don't know that accelerationism is the answer. I do think that there are contradictions at the heart of capitalism that cause it eventually to have some type of crisis. Who knows what will come?
Yeah, we need a reckoning.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that the Great Awakening is the reckoning that we need. It's certainly not the tech bro reckoning that they're looking at, you know, is to rise above the chrysalis of matter as pure consciousness before the planet explodes, or, you know, to get off, or to, you know. And I understand they look at all the other humans as sort of the larval state, you know, and they are the flies that get the wings that actually go off and harvest and colonize new places.
Gross.
That one doesn't work for me, not in the short term anyway, or the medium term. Maybe the super long term. So thousands of years from now, we have warp drives and, you know, send a few scouts out to Alpha Centauri or, you know, whatever.
There doesn't seem to be any, it's correct. It's like there is a kind of escape velocity they all want to reach in some way that to continue the party. And I think, like, it's weird because we're entering an age in which the writing's on the wall, like the music is slowing, like we know that, and the party's coming to an end, but like we're not really sure how or why or in what way. And like that kind of thing is really terrifying in many types of ways. And I think that the end to their reality is going to spell a kind of doom, and hopefully it won't be, you know. But I can see reading your book, I can see why there are people who are projecting big C conspiracies on all kinds of things. Like, obviously conspiracies exist by definition, but like I don't buy into, like, it's so strange to believe that there are big C conspiracies going on, because people are quite frankly just not this well organized. Like, in how are we gonna put nanobots in syringes that go all over the planet? We couldn't even pull out of one fucking country very well.
Yeah, no, like, they can't. They're shit for brains, these people. But I totally. But it's certainly, on the one hand, it's very comforting to believe that somebody's in charge and that there is this conspiracy that, you know, there's some great reset or thing that's going to happen. But I'll tell you, the if you believed that the world really is going to kind of end, then wouldn't you sort of want to be there
when
it happens? It's like, worst case, at least if it's like, well, I'm like, all right, I turned 60. So it's like, well, we better get this show on the road if I'm going to be alive for the thing. It's like, come on.
Wait a minute. You mean I got to die before the world ends?
Like, yeah. It's like, what? It's like,
no. Yeah.
Right. I think that's part of it. You know, it's like, let's bring it on already. And it's also because of the whole Present Shock problem, and we're out of the story and all. It's like, well, at least we can get the one big story. I don't know what my life is. I don't know what marriage is. I don't know if I believe in God, but I'm going to be here for the grand finale.
The end of the world. Yeah, Patton Oswalt has a great bit that I love. He's a comedian who's absolutely super talented. And he goes, if you're here for the apocalypse, you have the greatest story to tell in the afterlife. Like, it's just it's so much cooler.
Oh, totally. Everyone's going to want to hear.
Car accident. How'd you die? Fire ants. How'd you die? How'd I die? In the motherfucker. fucking apocalypse.
I know, but that's going to be a very popular line. I mean, there's going to be 8 billion, you know, people who can say it. So, you know, this car is true. There will be actually quite, be fewer at that point.
Quite a lot of people.
You strangled? You were strangled? Ooh, come on, Morris. This guy was strangled.
Morris. You know,
it makes sense. Whatever, you know.
Hey, we'll have you over for dinner here in the afterlife.
But I understand that, but... assuming we don't want that, you know, the real problem here is not, and I tried to say that in Present Shock too, the real problem is not the present shock so much as our addiction to narrative. So it's like, yes. Okay, we've exposed that the narratives aren't real. The stories aren't real. There's no beginning, middle, and end. Everything just kind of is and rolling along and strange. It's becoming comfortable with that. And how do you be comfortable with that, with no ending? No, the Titanic is not sinking.
Sinking,
We're just going along here.
There's no resolution. There's no, right. And that's why, like, referencing the Coen brothers, I think is so interesting, because I do think that there's a sublime truth to the idea that there are lots of stories without resolutions. That's a more, you talk about it a little bit in the book, I think, which is this kind of experimental theater almost, where like Brecht, or like there's this kind of, it's just
Brecht
things
and
sometimes
David
just
Lynch
end.
And it just
maybe
goes.
There's a, maybe instead of Chekhov's gun not, you know, going off, it just is on stage and then it never goes off, and then the play
it goes
ends
off, but he fails to kill himself. Oh no, he does at the very end. He does. Yeah. He finally succeeds. You know, it would be more, it's actually more Chekhov if he fails. If it's like, ah, he grazed himself, ah, the fool, you know, all right, let's just sit here, you know, that would be the more Beckett thing. Did you kill yourself? No, it didn't work today. All right, try again tomorrow. All right, same place, same time.
Dude, I love that all the absurdist references we're making back and forth. Like,
yeah, but it's like, well, existentialism gets to absurdism in comedy, but it makes it tolerable because, all right, so the world, we don't understand the world. There is no meaning, blah, 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 but there's 200 people sitting in a room laughing together.
All laughing
about
together.
This.
You know what?
And that's the whole point.
And you know what? Life isn't so bad.
Right.
Like, you know, whatever. We've been, have a drink or don't, whatever you feel like doing. You know, shake hands with your neighbor. Like, it's not that big of a deal, actually.
It was funny. Yeah, I was reading Bruce Sterling, the science fiction writer, you know, kind of libertarian, crazy, wonderful guy. He spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, and he was writing on one of these bulletin boards. He was saying, you know, I think more people need to experience, you know, what it's like to live in a kind of Soviet bloc country where the people are like, they've really given up on the big, right? But they've learned then how to have a different kind of camaraderie and fun together, you know, around the table, sitting, you know, there's something to be said for
small
that.
Small moments that are actually more meaningful. I really think, because you know what's an underlying theme, I think, to some of your writing, especially in Present Shock, has been this kind of dopamine addiction that I feel like everyone has. Like, I've decided this month to try to go on a dopamine cleanse. So I'm not scrolling. I'm not streaming anything. I'm like, I'm listening to audio, but I'm trying to avoid doing anything I would normally do to get a dopamine hit. And it's really hard. Like, it's really hard.
Oh, you know what helps? Do a mushroom trip.
Yeah.
If you do a real mushroom trip, it becomes a lot easier to then not, you know what I mean? It's sort of like you do something like that. You don't want to eat meat or something. There's a
interesting
because that's what I did. And I'm totally off this shit now.
All off the dopamine. Well, I'll do that coming up next week. I did ayahuasca last year, and that was pretty wild. 3-day retreat. And it was like, I mean, my head went to another dimension, you know? So then I came back and I'm like, man, maybe these conspiracy theorists are onto something, dude. Like,
They're onto something. But the object of the game then is to learn to, I hate to use the word like tolerate, but at least at the beginning, is to learn to tolerate an utter lack of narrative. It's not nihilist. Mm-hmm. It's not even existentialist. It's just, I mean, can't you be the the happy nihilist, the it's not like you're happy nihilist sounds like you're like Dexter.
No,
or something.
But this is John Marmish's point in his book Laughing at Nothing, which is that there's no point. And so you can create whatever you want. So the absurd that you can appreciate, like I'm a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft, the horror writer from the early 20th century. He invented the concept of cosmic horror, right? But it's interesting because Rick and Morty, the TV show, is almost a cosmic humor. Like, it oscillates so quickly between terror and humor, but there is so much humor in this weird, like, abyss, nothing nihilism that we're all running away from. Like, you even mentioned Ernst Becker, I think, and I forget which book, but The Denial of Death, and how, you know, we're all attempting to amass these fortunes in order to prove our living selves and run away from death. But like, the strange thing about it is, like, if you just accept the idea that you're like, this is just absurd and it's weird that we're here, there's something really funny about that. And you can start appreciating the humor in life around you. Like, there's
beautiful. We're conscious. I mean,
like, and I don't want to be in a Black Mirror episode. I don't want somebody to download my intelligence in a computer for all eternity. Like, I think it's a lot better that we have a finite amount of time that we have to make the best of.
Exactly. And even if there's an infinitesimal possibility, or only an infinitesimal small possibility, that there's something after you die, what if there is?
Yeah. And you know what? It might not be that great. So you should probably try to have a great time now.
Now, right. It could be like, this could be the good part. That could be like the, oh my God.
Yeah, dude.
The waiting on lines and stuff, like in the Defending Your Life movie. You're just waiting on lines and
this should be so,
getting processed.
It sounds so disappointing. I think if there's an afterlife, it's probably pretty decent. If you were a decent person, let's hope.
So do you make enough money just being funny to live?
Oh man, what are you, my in-laws? Jesus. I don't. Yeah, I run a comedy club here in New York, and we do okay, but
so you've got meta on your profession. You've leveled up. You're a rentier.
I've leveled up.
So other comics pay you to be on your stage and to try to be funny themselves.
Yeah, well, we have other comics don't pay, but we sell tickets because we do a lot of great shows. And
it's not pay to play. That's good.
Yeah, it's not pay to play.
Because there are these places in New York. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Yeah.
I won't even
for
talk
sure.
about it. They're kind of pyramid scheme comedy improv places.
Completely.
Oh my God, it's such a scam. Nothing personal. Yeah. I'm sure it's not a scam. I'm sorry. I didn't say that.
No, they're cashing in on your dreams of comedy glory. That's
right.
What they're cashing
in
on.
When I was doing rock, you know, I actually played with a real band with Psychic TV, you know, going around. And what I realized after my, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 years in the rock and roll business is the only one making money is Guitar Center.
Right? Oh yeah, dude.
Everybody else is working to support their I mean, you know, unless you get to like Hall & Oates level or whatever it is.
All the people who made money in the gold rush were selling pickaxes, man. It's exactly the same. It's like very similar. Yeah. So no, we it's called the Sunflower Arcade Lounge. It's in the West Village. We run shows like many nights of the week. It's a lot of fun.
You own a building? You rent a space? How does this happen?
We have a relationship with the building, basically the venue owner. And so we run out of the basement of that place. It's really cool. We've got like a lot of amazing comedians have come through and done it. I've done comedy for like 20 years. I started when I was in high school. I've got two uncles who are stand-up comics and just fell in love with it and continue to do it. And it's weird because I mean, obviously the goal is to become more famous and to be running a lot of this stuff. I think it's been challenging a little bit for me because I think that I'm still, even though I'm this far into comedy, working out my own identity on stage a little bit because I'm a complicated guy. And like I read Doug Rushkoff and Jean Baudrillard and Albert Camus and like all these guys, and I'm kind of an existential person, but I also enjoy a dick joke from time to time. So
right. It is tricky.
It's a lot.
It is tricky. I mean, some people have done it though. There was the guy with the caveman show on Broadway. He kind of went, what was that guy? He went there. Bo Burnham's been really good at sort of
Bo
pushing
Burnham
through,
is amazing.
But he stuck with this sort of the impact of digital technology on the way we think. So it was kind of tightly focused, at least for a while. And the music, he's doing musical comedy.
Man. The guy he can't be stopped. Like, he's a good actor. He's a good director. I mean, that movie he made,
Eighth Grade was
fantastic. Like, he's a musician. All of his music's amazing. I mean, I started following him when he first started writing music on YouTube because I was like, this guy's really good. And he's tall, so you can't beat him.
But he's native to this space, right? He's native to the present shocky digital space. And that gives me certain faith that, okay, you know, nature, nurture, whatever it is, you could be raised in the simulacrum and still see it for what it is, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, I think that part of the reason that Gen Z is so checked out or whatever, like, I think that the millennial generation, my generation, is strange because I'm sort of a, you know, I almost identify more with Gen X than I do with, Gen Z.
Yeah.
And because Gen X people, like, we grew up in a similar, like, you and I grew up in a similar culture, which is like magazines, prints, like there was a certain amount, MTV, like there was a certain amount that was accessible in a very particular way. And I think that the odd thing is, like, that narrative you're talking about, that America, that meta narrative, that started to fall apart in my generation. I think that millennials feel betrayed in a way. Like, I feel like, oh, I bought a bill of sale for a bunch of goods that weren't what I was given. Like, I'm not going to probably, most people are, millennials are going to have trouble affording a house. Like, we have all this college debt that we're working our asses off to pay off. Like, we bought into the narrative. And I think Gen Z's now grown up in a world where that type of fractured narrative and all of the simulation and simulacra and hyper reality, they grew up in all of that stuff. And they're just like, yeah, this just sucks. I'm not going to do this. This doesn't seem like a good way to do anything. And I kind of envy them, but I almost weirdly can't relate to them because I feel like I'm inherently, like, I want to believe, you know what I mean? Like, I want to believe the narrative so bad, except it's, like, not true. And it's a gulf that I wish I could bridge. But I think Bo Burnham was, I think he was a native of that space. He grew up right in it.
Yeah. And it is hopeful too that I'm seeing, you know, Josh, the producer of this show, does something called Digital Void, which they do it at Caveat Lounge on, you know, NBC or whatever.
Yeah.
And they do this every month. They do an event and they basically have, like, smart people with PowerPoints kind of doing stand-up mimetic analysis of things. And people are coming out. I mean, you do shows, people are coming to, even post-COVID, whatever it is, they're coming out and I think they understand that there's something to be had with live, connected humans in a room.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the next thing, actually. I think that there's going to be a wave of people wanting to go see things in person. I think that there's a desire to feel connected to a real performance and to a real performer and not just witness things virtually. I really do think that that's going to be me and my business partners talk about this a lot. I think that there's going to be a major shift in this. Live theater, I think, is going to make a comeback. I think that there's going to be a number, probably in the next 5 years, I think there's going to be a number of very big plays that are not just like Hamilton, but just a bunch of plays that are not spectacle productions, but productions of meaningful, interesting theater that people will want to go see, that the creators of which will probably be like, no, we're not going to produce a film about this. You have to go see it live, or it has to be produced in your community. Sorry, that's the way it's going to be. And I think that that's actually going to happen.
Yeah. Now, I could see that, you know, and because you could see the crazies are already kind of gearing up. They're it's weird. I just saw, who was it? Alex Jones and Elon Musk on a YouTube together.
Amazing.
Saying Team Human.
Yeah. Good God.
They came up with Team Human. But Team Human, you know, that we're on Team Human now, not Team Machine or Team Human. And talking about the same stuff we are, in a sense, but from Crazy Land. But you know, it's Naomi Klein's doppelganger mirror thing going on.
So good.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's amazing.
But it's to see, for her to admit it too, right, that you get lost in it. She got lost in that. You know, it's the same stuff you're talking about, that you get lost in. You don't know where you are. You can't have your bearings anymore. And there's your mirror. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. Am I that crazy also?
I think if you're on a YouTube show with Alex Jones, you are that crazy.
Right. I guess. I mean, luckily I'm not. Though I was invited to Bannon. I talked about that a lot, whether or not to do it.
Oh my gosh. What?
Yeah, to do Bannon, because he liked Team Human. He was reading from the book, but he likes it because it, from his perspective, it exposes the great conspiracy of the technocrats against the humans. Look at them. They're going to leave us behind. And it's like, no, you're supposed to laugh at them, not take them seriously. Right?
Oh, my gosh. Doug, this was great, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Sure. I appreciate you coming on. And we should play together. I should come to your space. What's it called? Everyone should go there. What's it called?
Sunflower Arcade Lounge.
Sunflower Arcade Lounge. It's not every night that you have certain nights there.
Yeah, yeah. We have, if you just Google it, you'll see that we got a lot of great reviews. I'm really happy. People have really been very positive. The experience has been good, which is good because we like try really hard to make it like a unique, like this is a, you dig it too. It's got a kind of punk rock, like DIY vibe, which is really cool. And it's getting great reviews. People love it. You can go check it out on Google and then it'll go straight to the Eventbrite. So you can just pick up tickets there.
Cool. Like, yeah. We should do a Team Human there.
Dude, come out, man. We'd love to have it. Like, it's cool. Yeah. It's got a backdrop of all these old arcade games from the 80s. Like, the whole thing is a real 80s vibe down there. So it's like it's supposed to feel like oh man, I stepped back in time a little bit and like this thing that doesn't, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. Because kids today, like, this is so strange, but like kids today like didn't grow up. I was like the last generation that grew up with actual arcades. Where like you wanted to go play video games, you had to go get a $5 bill from somebody and then go to a dark room at the mall or like Space somewhere.
Yeah.
And then like go hang out and play video games or and then watch other kids play video games too.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. I was a Joust kid.
We got Joust, man. We got Galaga. Yeah. We've got Joust. We have Defender. We've got Joust was a great one.
Yeah. It was one of the first games designed by a woman. And
really?
You had a flap. You hit a button to flap the wings.
Flap the wings. Yeah. And then you had to like hit other people on top. This is the best. The game
you're
was so
jousting
much fun.
On flying dragons. Yeah, gorgeous.
People don't know, man. People forget.
All right, but we will. We will inform them. We will orient them to the truth of the video game reality in which we live. Excellent. Thank you for being on Team Human, and we'll see you very soon.
Thanks, Doug.
And thank you for being on Team Human. Our guest today was comedian and existential Midwesterner Brendan Lemon. You can find him at Brendan Freaking Lemon on TikTok, brendanlemon.com for an outdated website, or just go straight to the Sunflower Arcade Lounge in Greenwich Village and see him and his friends live. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human. Our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.